please sit comfortably. If you're sitting down and you want to sit up, do it. Make yourself comfortable. And good evening, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to those I haven't seen before. And I want to talk tonight about the third treasure, the Sangha treasure. And this is a series of talks that I'll give over the course of the coming times as we explore this Sangha treasure, which I don't know if you noticed tonight, but the depth of presence of the Sangha when we're all sitting together in silent stillness. It's so intimate, such an intimate way to be with others, where we can just drop all of the presentation and experience our common energetic body. So I want to take up this teaching on the Sangha and the theme of Sangha friendship, because friendship is certainly part of Sangha. But I'd like to begin with a poem by Wordsworth. I have seen a curious child who dwelt upon a tract of inland ground, applying to his ear the convolutions of a smooth-lipped shell, to which, in silence hushed, his very soul listened intensely, and his countenance soon brightened with joy. For from within were heard murmurings, whereby the monitor expressed mysterious union with its native sea. Even such a shell, the universe itself is to the ear of faith. And there are times, I doubt not, when to you it doth impart authentic tidings of invisible things, of ebb and flow, and ever-during power, and central peace subsisting at the heart of endless agitation. Central peace subsisting at the heart of endless agitation could be a wonderful description of Sangha friendship. Friendship that is based on a shared appreciation for the open heart, kind of the vast open mind, a shared awareness and consciousness of all of life. So may our practice in Sangha promote the knowing of this central peace subsisting at the heart of endless agitation, the endless agitation of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or even the talk on Sunday morning, which was broadcast this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Endless agitation. And we turn toward our place of practice and our community, where together we cultivate the Bodhisattva way. Your practice and my practice are the same, to remind and encourage each other to cultivate this central peace, cultivate this awareness of central peace, which is already always available and discovered in true friendship. And when you think about your best friends, the truest sense of friendship, there is at the heart of it all a sense of great peace and openness. So this is the meaning of the Sangha as treasure. This is the treasure that we commit to discovering in our common practice. One day, Ananda, who was the Buddha's dear attendant and companion of many, many years. He was contemplating the role of friendship in his own life. And realizing how important friendship is, he went to the Buddha and said, "Friendship constitutes half of the spiritual life, Lord." And the Buddha replied, "Not so, Ananda. It is the whole of spiritual life. It is the whole of spiritual life." When we think of loving-kindness practice, one of the divine abidings, it is friendliness at the very heart, friendliness toward all living beings. This is the way of the Bodhisattva, friendliness, a priori friendliness, not based on common interests, common opinions, common prejudices, but it is a goodness at the heart of all things and sharing a goodness at the heart of all of life. In the Six Paramitas Sutra, the Buddha says, "The Sangha jewel is a field of blessings. It can bestow peace and bliss upon all sentient beings. Moreover, this Sangha jewel is pure and undefiled. It is able to dispel the darkness of living beings' greed, hatred, and stupidity. Like the bright light of the full moon that all beings gaze at with awe in the evening. It is also like a precious mani jewel that can fulfill all the good wishes of sentient beings." What's really interesting to me about this quote is that it's not spoken about as personal. It is the Sangha treasure is something that we all can partake of. It's an attitude, it's an approach to our relationships to all beings. So our challenge is to remember the Sangha as a field of blessings, especially when it is thorny, when there is conflict, when there are varying opinions, when there's attitude that just slips out in the midst of an exchange. Friendship, the intention to friendship, permeates the life of the Sangha. But there's a catch and a challenge to this. The Sangha is a group, and any group has group process, and it can go in a lot of different directions. So talking about the Sangha jewel, we have to be careful not to get some idealized version of how we should be, how we're supposed to be, because it's not talking about performance here. It's talking about intention and the clarity of how at the heart of friendliness lies an intention to be friendly, always. I mean, it's that simple, really. If you think about, you know, confronting somebody who's really irked with you, if you don't have a really clear intention to be friendly, it's very easy to get drawn right into that same energy. But if you have an intention to be friendly, sometimes that can come through and instantly transform the interaction. But even when it doesn't, it can bring a kind of dormancy to the reactive energy when one person doesn't dive in too. When there's a kindness at the heart of it that is like, oh, Thich Nhat Hanh is so good at expressing this. He always says in his sweet way, which is very cultural to the Vietnamese culture, "Friend, I know that I see that you're suffering." Well, you know, if you were to say that to somebody who's really pissed off at you, you're inviting a punch in the nose. It can be really patronizing. So you don't have to display that, but you can remember it internally. So our experience in the Sangha can trigger the feelings that our original group, our family of origin, patterned in us. We may have been the star, or the troublemaker, or the clown, or the one who spent most of their time in their room, or somewhere outside of the house. We might have been abused in any number of ways, or abandoned in that family. We may have been tormented by siblings or had a best friendship with a brother or sister, or else been betrayed and set up by them. So we carry these patterns forward into our lives. So many kinds of wounds and also blessings from that first family where we felt we belonged or we didn't belong. All of that first patterning really sets us up to expect the world to be and a group to be a certain way. The Sangha can be nurturing and healing, and or it can be toxic and create the worst kind of suffering. And both of these arise in sanghas. And it's what we learn from and learn how to be aware of in the group that is the sangha. This is our place. We are all committed to becoming aware of our internal experience and also the behaviors we use to cope with this experience. The ways that we really try to get along, some of which are skillful, some of which are not skillful, some of which used to work, but they don't work now. And the only thing that cuts through all of that is awareness. Really being aware. Whenever we behave from our long reinforced and almost invisible to us habits of dis-ease, where we get judgy or withdrawn or we collude with another Sangha member or condemn or shame ourselves, that's frequently an experience people have. In Zen practice, in spiritual practice, the shame of, look how everybody's sitting, they're just so transported in their meditation, but I'm sitting here just really thinking about something that's bothering me and I can't shut it up. And the feeling of just disapproving of ourselves, that we're not meeting some standard, some idealized standard of internal states. So then we need to practice remembering this as a refuge and renew our work to realize how this is a field of blessings. This is a cohort of others who are really wanting to break free of the suffering habits, the ways that we all bring suffering forth. Kisei Kostenbader, the Reverend Kisei Kostenbader, wrote, "The heart that recognizes its abundance is present, open, and full of gratitude. Through the cool, wet, and dark times of year, practicing with community can be a continued reminder of our inherent fullness." May this be so. We get there sometimes. We do get to know ourselves through this intricate and relentless practice of inquiry, where we're taking a look at our own mind stream and asking at the same time, who is taking a look? And that's what's going on in meditation. We look at what's going on in the mind. We also have to take one more step and say, well, who's looking? Because when I am looking at what's going on in my mind, there's an I and a something else going on. There's still that separation. And we play that out collectively, too, in our sangha. So Thich Nhat Hanh says, mindfulness is the fundamental precept. For those who are going to be taking precepts, mindfulness is the fundamental precept. Fundamental means lies at the base of the precepts, the base of behaving with integrity and care. And the precept, one of his precepts reads, do not utter words that can cause division and hatred, that can create discord and cause the family or community to break. All efforts should be made to reconcile and resolve all conflicts. That's a wonderful intention. It doesn't always work out, but it doesn't work out unless there is the intention. There's that thing about conflict being inevitable. When you have two separate people, you're going to see things differently. You're not always going to see things the same way. If you know how to take up conflict with the intention to learn and to grow from it, then it's an opportunity for getting closer and also understanding more fully your life and the other's life. But if you avoid it or you do it in unskillful ways, it just creates division and more alienation. And so in our Sangha, may we, over time, become skillful enough to take up the conflicts that come. We've done it quite a bit so far as we've come along in this project of building, which is a very strife-filled unfolding. A lot of marriages break up during remodels, right? We didn't. We were so far so good, but there have been conflicts. We've been really working with it as practice, the Sangha jewel. So we can try to be mindful of this fundamental precept of mindfulness when we form alliances within the Sangha that serve to judge and separate, and come back to refuge in the Sangha practice of mindful engagement, engaging with our own vulnerability and that of our Sangha friends. So I wanted just to mention that one of the things in the Vinaya, the rules for ordained people, and it's gone through with all kinds of monastic settings, is there's a rule against special friendships, which can sound really cruel and mean, and it can feel that way. Because obviously we do have certain affinities with certain people. We have natural friendships with some people and not so natural with others. But what that's really getting at is, wake up to the potential for harming and hurting, and treat each other as a jewel. Treat each other in a way that nurtures the other with kindness and a wish to know them, to understand them. Nobody comes across like a creep intentionally. It's skillful behavior gone awry. It's an attempt to cope with some internal experience, right? And that's true for all of us. We're all assholes sometimes. And, you know, what's behind it? Well, it's up to us in this practice to look into. When I'm really out of sorts and not being very skillful, what is, if I'm going to be vulnerable and really open, what is it that's going on for me? And same for others. That's the approach. Sangha practice is demanding. And it's also a most valuable aspect of what this practice has to offer. taking up our own path of knowing deeply the nature of our minds and hearts, and how our behaviors follow. In every situation, not just in the Sangha, everywhere. We have to ask ourselves, does my practice rest on openness and listening and truth-telling and being willing to be vulnerable when I am vulnerable, when I don't know or I'm afraid or I'm hit with an inner critic attack? How willing am I to experience my life So we think about Sangha as a family, first of all. We live together. We share a lineage. We share offspring. What we do in the Sangha now either attracts or repels newcomers. So anybody new is an offspring, really. We have a related language. Sometimes it's pretty obscure, hard to learn. But we're here to try to help each other with that, to learn what it is. We certainly have something very odd in common. This is such an odd practice. It's a religion, yes, because it has all of the kind of organizational stamps of religion, but it's not a religion of belief. It's a way of inquiry with a very long and storied tradition of teachings. We're an organization which has coordinated components and effectiveness of arrangements. That's the dictionary speaking now. Well, we try. That's all I can say. Coordinating? I don't know. We're a corporation. We are a group acting as a single entity. That's true. That's true. We're a single entity. And in the world, all of life is a single entity acting as a group of individuals, right? That's the view that we really need to really get now. One life, many bodies. And then we're a community. We share a common background and live under similar conditions. Somewhat. Not all. This is a factor in our Sangha now. You know, there are a number of people in Sangha who are retired and freer to kind of accommodate serving the Sangha. And then there are others who are working and have young families at home or have grandchildren that they are responsible for too often, and not so available. And to be really aware of each other's life circumstance, because it's not the same. Some people don't have any kind of money at all. Some people have lots of money. And that really affects how we think about policy and how we approach various needs. So, as a Sangha, we take responsibility for our own continuous practice. We all take a vow, the vows of the Sangha, the four great Bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them from the effects of my own unskillful actions, would be one way to see that. When I awaken, all beings awaken, says the Buddha. What does that mean? And we look into that as a primary koan. What does it mean when I awaken, all beings awaken? And then, what's the second one? Beings are numberless. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Yeah. Okay, good luck. But the thing is, a vow is an ongoing thing. The only time we can end a delusion is in the moment of the arising of that particular delusion, right? That delusion of separateness. So it's ongoing. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Every moment is a Dharma gate. Every moment we can be really present or distracted. And then the Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. And that points us to this is an embodied practice. Our life, we embody our life. How do we take care of our body? The body of our life and the body of our body. How do we take care of our health? That's a whole big inquiry in itself. So now I get to why I'm giving this talk, or how it came up, which is we need a logo. We need a logo. And a logo for Sangha Jewel Zen Center. So graphically, what's a logo? It's an archetypal image. A logo for a Sangha needs to be simple, and a Sangha is not a simple matter. Engaging to the eye and heart, so pleasing, interesting. It needs to be authentic. There's something about it that's real, that's not tacky or like meant to impress or something a little bit off. And it needs to be authentic to the nature of what it stands for, what it represents. So this is the way we aspire to inspire with our logo. With our logo, we want to inspire each person who arrives at to practice at our center. And every time we send out a piece of stationery or a request for funding or a thank you note, we express our Sangha Jewel in some visual way.
Yeah.
You just figured it out? Okay. All right. I'll talk to you later.
Store them.
So we're looking for a form that represents us, the Sangha, and our Bodhisattva vow. And so that someone seeing it for the first time recognizes it in a certain way. The most powerful logos, they just really catch you. There's something so intimately true and interesting. And it's archetypal. And now I just want to slip in a plug for a documentary series on Netflix that I just discovered called Abstract, The Art of Design. It's brilliant. And I don't know how many episodes it has, but I've seen two, and they're just riveting. And it reminds me of this whole project of looking for a logo. How form, it's really about the dharmas of form. What does form bring forward in our experience? Anyway, I really suggest everybody take a look if you're looking for something good. Jung calls the archetype a tendency to form. So we tend toward the bodhisattva. We tend to generate, to cultivate our energies in the direction of being of benefit, being friendly, being patient, open. This is the tendency that we want to cultivate in ourselves, the form. And an archetype is, where is it? I have a good definition. I don't know what happened to it. Okay. The Sangha is just a form. It's a word. It's a symbol. Until we live it, it's a word. But when we live it, it's a living being, animated by its nature and what it calls forth in us. Where does the Sangha end and I begin? That's a really good koan to work with. Where does the Sangha end and I begin? Where do I end and the Sangha begin? We are the Sangha, and the Sangha is us. Refuge is also an archetype that we come to appreciate as we feel the deep relief that comes to us through this life of practice with others, being part of a friendly group. Refuge is not a place. It doesn't lie outside you or me. It is complete activity. It's the quality of complete unobstructed activity, giving and receiving friendship. So refuge is not a place, it's a verb, and requires continual practice, as continual as our life is, moment by moment, by moment. So I want to read a little quote from Larry Yang, who is a Zen teacher, insight meditation teacher. In mainstream society, with all of its unconsciousness, even the most liberating teachings sometimes cannot be absorbed without the right conditions. Creating the external and internal conditions that allow the teachings to land deeply into our experience is critical for spiritual growth. I'm going to read that sentence again. Creating the external and internal conditions that allow the teachings to land deeply into our experience is critical for spiritual growth. This is the beauty of the refuge of Sangha, which the Buddha said was an indispensable part of our path. So this is primary realization as we mature in Sangha practice. The Buddha and the way of the Bodhisattva refers to something so personal, ordinary, everyday, intimate, and elicits something that each of us can only experience for ourselves. So we are charged with providing for each other a context, a communal home, where we can all begin to realize the central peace subsisting at the heart of endless agitation. Agitation does not have to cease for us to find peace. So may we all help each other with this.
Please turn to page 5.